weather trends, expert takes, and the truth behind the data, you're listening to Weather Waves, found at WXWaves.com.
Imagine a landscape where the very air is thick with smoke, homes just engulfed in flames, and emergency responders facing dangers escalating, well, by the hour.
Yeah, we've all seen those images, those headlines.
Heard the statistics, too. In recent decades, extreme wildfire behavior has surged. It's dramatically increasing risk for communities and, you know, those on the front lines.
Leading to immense property losses, huge costs. Uh-huh. It's really become a national crisis.
It touches us all. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into the incredibly complex and, frankly, urgent challenge of wildland fire management.
And it's complex, all right?
This isn't just about putting out fires anymore, is it? It seems like it's about learning to live with them.
Exactly. And to guide us through this critical topic, we've pulled together a stack of sources. The main one is a landmark document. It's called the National Cohesive Wildland Fire Management Strategy.
Okay, National Cohesive Strategy. Sounds important.
It is. This isn't just another report. It was actually mandated by Congress back in the Flame Act of 2009.
The Flame Act, right. That was about funding and coordination.
Precisely.
Yeah.
The Federal Land Assistance Management and Enforcement Act. So the strategy, it's the result of a massive, multi-phased planning process. It brought together federal, state, local, tribal governments, non-governmental partners, even the public.
So a lot of stakeholders involved.
A huge number. And we'll also be drawing on some crucial supporting materials, you know, from sources like iAlert.com and NOAANWS for insights into, like, severe weather alerts, wildfire risk, warnings, and importantly, preparedness.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Our mission today is to, well, cut through some of that complexity, try to understand the core challenges of living with wildfire.
Yeah, get to the heart of it.
And discover this national vision you mentioned, and maybe find some practical steps we can all take to build, you know, truly fire-adapted communities and landscapes.
That's the goal.
So, this strategy lays out an overarching vision for our future with fire. It really does sound like a profound shift in how we think about it. Not just destructive, but something we coexist with. What does that actually look like?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the vision isn't simply about, you know, fighting fires harder or faster. It's truly comprehensive. The official wording is to safely and effectively extinguish fire when needed, use fire where allowable, manage our natural resources, and as a nation, live with wildland fire.
Live with wildland fire. That's the key phrase.
That's the core insight, yes. Living with fire is the long-term goal. And this isn't just a wish. It's backed by three primary national goals.
Okay, what are they?
First, to restore and maintain landscapes so they're resilient to fire-related disturbances.
Meaning they can bounce back.
Exactly. They can recover quickly from a fire rather than being, well, destroyed by it. Second, to foster fire-adapted communities so our homes, our infrastructure, can actually withstand wildfire without catastrophic loss.
That seems critical, especially with more people living near wildlands.
Absolutely. And third, to ensure an effective wildfire response, where all jurisdictions, federal, state, local, make safe, effective, and efficient risk-based decisions, especially when things, you know, escalate.
And this is all guided by some core principles.
Right. Things like prioritizing firefighter and public safety above all else, sound risk management, actively managing our land, and crucially, recognizing that fire is actually an essential ecological process in many environments. It's not always the enemy.
Living with wildland fire.
Yeah.
It's a powerful statement and maybe a challenging one for many people to grasp.
Yeah.
But here's where it gets really interesting, I think. Before we dive deeper into the strategy itself, let's talk about the fundamentals of fire. What actually makes a wildfire tick, makes it rage out of control?
Right, the basics. Well, at its core, fire boils down to what we call the fire triangle. You need three things.
Heat, fuel, oxygen. Learned that in school.
That's it. Heat for ignition and spread. Fuel, which is any material that will burn from grass to trees to houses, and oxygen from the air to break down that fuel and release heat.
Sounds simple enough.
It sounds basic, but the real insight is how these three elements conspire with, like, weather and the lay of the land topography to create that unpredictable and often deadly extreme fire behavior that can just defy conventional firefighting.
Ah, so it's the interaction that's key. What are those factors?
Several key factors dramatically influence how a wildfire behaves and spreads. Weather conditions are huge. Wind speed, for instance.
I bet.
Oh yeah, massive effect on intensity and how fast it travels. It pushes flames forward, preheats the fuel ahead of it. Temperature, humidity, precipitation, they all influence how dry the fuel is.
Fuel moisture, right?
Exactly. Then there's spotting. This is where wind and the fire's own heat, the thermals, carry sparks and burning embers, firebrands downwind, sometimes miles ahead.
Miles.
Oh, yeah. Starting new fires, greatly accelerating the spread rate. Then, of course, the fuel type itself matters. The actual vegetation, its moisture content, its physical structure, chemical properties, all that dictates how the fire behaves. Is it grass, shrubs, heavy timber?
And finally, you mentioned topography.
Yes, topography, like the steepness of a slope. Fire burns much faster uphill because the flames are closer to the unburned fuel above, preheating it. Elevation and aspect, which direction a slope faces, also play a role.
So when all those things align in the wrong way,
that's when you get extreme fire behavior, those truly dangerous conditions. Fires moving incredibly fast, prolific crowning where the fire leaps through the tops of trees.
Like you see in the movies.
Yeah, and it's terrifyingly real. You get fire whirls, which are like these mini tornadoes of flame and strong convection columns, huge pillars of smoke and heat rising high into the atmosphere. It makes the fire incredibly erratic, unpredictable, and dangerous for firefighters.
Okay, so knowing this raw power of fire and how it interacts with the environment, it's crystal clear there's no one-size-fits-all problem across the U.S.
Not at all.
And definitely no single solution, right? The country's just too diverse. So how does a national strategy even begin to address such a varied landscape of risks?
This is actually where the strategy gets really clever, I think. It deliberately avoids a uniform approach. Instead, it classifies counties across the contiguous U.S. using two principal themes.
Two themes, okay.
First, by their landscape classes. This looks at things like the dominant land cover forest, grassland, shrubland, the historical fire patterns, what we call fire regimes.
How often fires naturally occurred.
Right, and how severe they typically were. It also considers the amount of public lands and levels of urban development. These landscape classes tend to have pretty strong geographical associations. You know, the forests of the West are different from the piney woods of the Southeast.
Makes sense. What's the second theme?
The second is community clusters. These are based more on the human element. Things like the amount of wildland-urban interface, or WUI.
That's the zone where houses meet the wildland, right?
Yeah.
The risky spot.
Exactly. Also, home density within that WUI, socioeconomic factors of the community, and importantly, how often wildfires actually occur and what causes them ignition density. And unlike the landscape classes, these community clusters can be scattered all over the country. You could have similar types of community risk profiles in very different geographic regions.
Yeah, I see. So one is about the land, the other about the people and structures on it.
Precisely. And the real insight, the real power here is in intersecting these two classifications. Overlaying them.
Okay, how does that help?
It gives us a much richer, more nuanced understanding of risk. We can see both the environmental and the socioeconomic dimensions at the same time for specific groups of counties. This allows for truly tailored approaches. It recognizes that, say, a wealthy, densely built, forested community in California faces very different challenges and might need different solutions than a sparsely populated, lower-income farming community in Georgia, even if both have technically high wildfire risk.
That intersection really highlights the nuances. It's not just the West burns. And it makes you realize how regionally specific these challenges become.
Absolutely. You take the Northeast, for example. You often find many relatively small human-caused fires there. But because populations can be dense, even in wooded areas, those small fires can pose a very high risk to life and property.
Right. The impact is high, even if the fire size isn't huge.
Exactly. Contrast that with the Southeast. They have a year-round fire season, a lot of fragmented private land, high human ignitions, but also a long history and extensive use of prescribed fire.
So there's more of a cultural acceptance of fire as a management tool there.
Generally speaking, yes. It's integrated into land management practices much more widely. And then you go out west, it's a different beast entirely.
How so?
Steep terrain, often long-term drought conditions, massive fuel buildup from well, a century of trying to exclude fire.
Bring out every fire.
Right. Plus, you have vast areas of public lands. So the focus there is often on protecting communities, obviously, but also managing those huge landscapes, protecting that middle ground, the areas between towns and the deep wilderness.
Okay, so with this understanding of fire behavior and these varied risks across the nation, the strategy then pinpoints four broad national challenges that need action.
That's right, four key areas.
Vegetation and fuels, homes, communities, and other values at risk, human-caused ignitions, and effective and efficient wildfire response. Let's start with that first one. Vegetation and fuels. It sounds like we're not just dealing with what's growing now, but a legacy problem.
Precisely. It's a huge legacy issue. Historically, many of these fire-adapted landscapes, forests, grasslands that evolved with fire experienced frequent low-severity fires. Think of it as a natural cleansing process.
Keeping the undergrowth in check.
Exactly. But over the last century or so, our efforts to suppress nearly all fires mean the average time between wildfires has now more than quadrupled in many of these areas.
Quadrupled? Wow.
Yeah. And that has led to a massive accumulation of vegetation, living and dead, all that organic material, what we call fuels. And this buildup means when fires do start, they have the potential to be much more intense, much more destructive.
So we've inadvertently created a bigger problem.
In many places, yes.
Yeah.
The strategy uses this great analogy. It's like walking up a down escalator. Just managing the current rate of fuel growth requires significant effort just to stay in place. To actually make progress, to reduce the accumulated backlog.
You have to move much faster than the escalator's going down.
Exactly. The challenge isn't just maintaining the status quo, it's actively reversing decades of fuel buildup across millions of acres.
That's a powerful image. But honestly, it sounds incredibly daunting. What are the opportunities? How can we possibly change this trajectory and make progress against that buildup?
Well, the strategy outlines three primary management options, three main tools in the toolbox. First, and often most effective, is prescribed fire.
Setting fires deliberately, under controlled conditions.
Correct. It's often the most cost-efficient way to manage vegetation, reduce hazardous fuels, and achieve ecological benefits simultaneously. The strategy sees opportunities to maintain and even expand its current use, like in the Southeast.
Where it's already common.
Right. And also to expand its use into new areas where it makes ecological sense, like parts of the West or maybe the Central Appalachians. But of course, we have to acknowledge prescribed fire carries inherent risks.
Like escapes or smoke impacting communities.
Exactly. Potential escapes, smoke hazards, impacts on air quality. It needs very careful planning, execution, and public communication. But the idea is that managed risk is often preferable to the risk of uncontrolled wildfire.
Okay, prescribed fire is one. What else?
Second, we can sometimes manage wildfire for resource objectives. This means under very specific pre-planned conditions, allowing certain naturally ignited wildfires, lightning strikes, for example, to burn, primarily to achieve ecological benefits like fuel reduction.
Letting nature do the work, basically.
Sort of, but under strict supervision. Its application is pretty limited, though, mostly on large, remote federal lands like wilderness areas. There are significant risks involved, and many states have laws requiring full suppression of all fires. So it's a niche tool.
Gotcha. And the third option?
The third is using non-fire treatments. This is a catch-all for things like mechanical thinning, using machinery to cut or shred vegetation.
Chainsaws and chippers.
Pretty much. Also biological methods like using targeted grazing goats or cattle to reduce fine fuels like grass and shrubs, and sometimes chemical treatments, herbicides, though that's less common for fuel reduction alone.
What are the advantages there? More control?
Generally, yes. More control over timing and outcome compared to fire. And in forested areas, especially if you're removing larger trees during thinning, there's potential for an economic offset if you can sell the timber or biomass.
So it can sometimes pay for itself, partly.
Potentially. And what's really interesting is the combination. Strategically using mechanical treatments first to thin out the dense stands or remove ladder fuels.
Stuff that lets fire climb into the trees.
Exactly. Doing that mechanical work first can make it much safer and more effective to then reintroduce prescribed fire later. It's often about using the right tool or combination of tools for the specific place and conditions.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's move to the second big challenge, protecting homes, communities, and other values at risk. We've seen the heartbreaking footage, the growing threat from development in that wildland-urban interface, the WUI. How can we better protect these communities?
Yeah, this is absolutely critical, and the responsibility is really shared. It's not just on firefighters. The strategy emphasizes a multifaceted approach focusing on home and community action.
Meaning actions by homeowners themselves.
Yes, individual property owners taking concrete steps. Reducing the ignitability of their actual home structure using fire-resistant roofing and siding screening vents, and creating defensible space around the home.
Clearing brush, trimming trees, that kind of thing.
Exactly. That space gives firefighters a chance to safely defend the home. That's crucial where structures are right next to flammable vegetation. But individual action isn't always enough.
Why not?
Because sometimes the threat comes from outside the immediate vicinity. A big fire starting miles away might shower a whole neighborhood with embers. So you also need community-level planning and coordinated action. Things like fuel breaks around the community, ensuring good access for fire engines, having evacuation plans.
So individual and collective efforts.
Absolutely. And then there's the critical role of building codes.
Ah, making new construction safer from the start.
Precisely. Implementing and enforcing codes that require fire-resistant materials and construction standards, especially for new buildings going up in high-hazard areas. This is incredibly effective over the long term. It's essentially building resilience right into the community's foundation.
Okay, that leads us to maybe the most sobering part of this, the fires we actually start ourselves. The third challenge. Human-caused ignitions. You said earlier most wildfires aren't natural?
That's right. It's a really stark reality check. The data shows human-caused ignitions are the predominant cause of wildfires in 98% of counties across the contiguous U.S.
98%? That's staggering.
It is. And they account for more area burned in 94% of counties. So it's not just small nuisance fires. Humans are responsible for the vast majority of fire starts and area burned.
What kind of human causes are we talking about? Campfires, cigarettes?
All sorts. Accidental fires are a big category. Things like unattended campfires, sparks from equipment, dragging chains, and especially debris burning getting out of control. That's a huge one in some regions.
Burning leaves or trash.
Yeah. Then you also have incendiary fires, arson. And those two categories, accidental and incendiary, often track together seasonally, peaking at different times than natural lightning ignitions, which usually follow a distinct summer peak in most places. The sheer volume of these human-caused fires represents a massive and potentially preventable problem.
So the obvious question is, how do we prevent these fires from starting in the first place? It sounds like prevention would give the biggest bang for our buck, but maybe also the hardest thing to achieve.
It's definitely challenging, but targeted prevention programs are absolutely key. And they need to be smart, data-driven. We need to reduce accidental ignitions by focusing efforts on the areas where they happen most often and burn the most acres. Places like the Southeast, the South Central States, the Far West.
And tailor the message.
Exactly. Tailor the programs to the specific causes that are dominant in that area. If debris burning is the main issue, focus on safe burning practices, permits, burn bans. If it's campfires, target outreach to recreational users.
And what about arson, the intentional fires?
That requires a different approach. To reduce intentional ignitions, we need to address the areas with high rates of incendiary fires and large areas burned, which often include large parts of the East and also populated areas in the West. This involves community engagement, vigilance, if you see something, say something type programs, and strong law enforcement efforts. It's really about understanding the who and why behind the ignitions in a specific place to effectively target the how of prevention.
Okay, prevention is key. But fires will still happen. That brings us to the final challenge, ensuring an effective and efficient wildfire response. You know, it's amazing, really, a testament to the thousands of firefighters, local, state, tribal, federal, that most fires are actually put out quickly when they're small.
Absolutely. The vast majority are suppressed during initial attack.
But the statistics are sobering. Yeah. You mentioned the top, 3% of fires account for over 90% of the area burned, the costs, the damages.
That's right. It's a huge insight. Those relatively few, very large fires are the truly challenging events. They're the ones that overwhelm initial response.
They strain the entire system.
They strain our extensive multi-jurisdictional response system often to its breaking point. They require massive amounts of resources, personnel, aircraft, logistics drawn from all over the country. They're the ones we really need to prepare for differently.
So what strategies are being developed or emphasized to improve how we respond specifically to these large, complex, long-duration events, the ones that make the news for weeks and cause such devastation?
Well, one key strategy is simply to prepare for large, long-duration wildfires more proactively. This involves identifying and prioritizing the areas with a high probability of experiencing these really big ones. What the strategy calls fires of concern, defined roughly as bigger than a square mile and lasting more than 2 weeks.
Where are those areas generally?
They include large parts of the West, obviously, but also significant areas in the Southeast, the Mid-Atlantic, and even parts of the Upper Midwest. These areas need enhanced preparedness, more prepositioned resources, better planning, maybe different training exercises focused on extended attack.
Just getting ready before they happen. What else?
Another strategic approach is about resource allocation during a fire. Protect structures and target landscape fields. In areas where we see a high rate of structure loss relative to the area burned, like parts of the Central Plains and many eastern regions, the priority for response resources should clearly be direct structure protection, saving homes.
Makes sense. But what about areas where huge areas burn, but maybe fewer structures are lost?
Right, like much of the Intermountain West. In those areas where you have vast landscapes burning but lower structure density, there might be opportunities for greater tactical flexibility. Maybe not trying to suppress every edge of the fire aggressively, potentially allowing parts to burn where it could provide ecological benefits, like reducing future fuel loads, and also potentially reducing costs and firefighter exposure. It's about risk-based decision-making.
A more nuanced approach, depending on what's at risk.
Exactly. And lastly, there's a strategy to protect structurals and target ignition prevention simultaneously. This involves connecting the initial response efforts directly back to reducing those accidental human ignitions, especially in areas where we see many buildings involved per incident, often in the east, more populated western counties. Maybe initial attack crews also distribute fire prevention information, or response data helps target future prevention campaigns. It's about closing the loop, being strategic with finite resources.
Okay, so we have the science, the regional variations, the big challenges, and these strategic options. But a national strategy document is one thing. Making it happen on the ground, across all those agencies, states, communities, that seems like the hardest part. How does this vision actually become reality?
You've hit on the core challenge, implementation. And the national strategy is quite explicit about the risk trade-offs involved. This is a really profound insight, I think, into a necessary mindset shift.
Risk trade-offs? What do you mean?
The ideal path forward, the strategy suggests, involves accepting a marginal increase in short-term risk, often from the expanded use of prescribed fire, or maybe managing some natural fires in order to achieve a significant reduction in long-term risk from catastrophic wildfires.
So accepting a little controlled smoke now to prevent a massive, uncontrollable fire later.
Essentially, yes. But that's a challenging pill for communities, land managers, and politicians to swallow, right? Accepting a controlled burn that might cause some temporary smoke impacts or has a small chance of escaping is tough. But the argument is that it's necessary to prevent those much larger, far more devastating future events.
That requires buy-in.
Huge buy-in. And it depends on several things. Careful prioritization of where we invest in treatments, a collective acceptance of that calculated short-term risk, and crucially, greater collective investment from all stakeholders, federal, state, local, private.
And how does the strategy envision coordinating all these different players?
It hinges on three essential organizational components. First, strategic alignment. Getting everyone, from federal agencies down to local fire departments and community groups, to agree on the overarching goals and the necessary actions. Second, communication and collaborative engagement. This means sharing information effectively, having transparent governance structures, and consistently monitoring progress together across all levels.
Keeping everyone on the same page.
Exactly. And third, programmatic alignment. This means ensuring that the individual objectives and budgets of each agency or organization actually support the national goals, recognizing that different entities have different roles, different legal mandates, different fiscal realities, but trying to get them all pulling in the same direction. It really emphasizes shared roles and responsibilities.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Maybe FEMA considers national wildfire risk priorities when awarding hazard mitigation grants. Or the U.S. Forest Service uses the national strategy's risk assessment to guide where they focus their fuels reduction projects. And it goes all the way down to individual homeowners understanding their role in creating defensible space. It has to connect top to bottom.
It's clear this deep dive really shows how crucial those individual actions are, not just for the grand strategy to work, but for our own immediate safety and the safety of our communities. What practical steps can listeners take right now? What can you do?
You're absolutely right. Individual and community preparedness is foundational. Drawing from great resources like the National Weather Service and iAlert, here are some key steps everyone can take. First, be prepared long before there's even smoke on the horizon.
What does that involve?
Create that defensible space around your home, clear dead vegetation, trim trees, keep gutters clean. Use fire-resistant landscaping where possible. Harden your home itself, screen vents, use non-combustible siding and roofing. Assemble an emergency supply kit.
Go bag.
Exactly. Water, non-perishable food, flashlights, batteries, a NOAA weather radio, medications, copies of important documents, some cash. Plan your escape routes out of your neighborhood, have more than one, and have a family meeting point outside the area. Review your insurance policy too, make sure it's up to date, and understand NWS alerts.
Like red flag warnings.
Yes. A red flag warning means critical fire weather conditions are happening now or will shortly, high winds, low humidity. It means take immediate action to prevent ignitions. A fire weather watch means conditions are favorable for dangerous fire weather soon, so be prepared.
Okay, so that's be prepared. What's next?
Second, get set. Be aware when there are active wildfires reported in your vicinity. This is when you pack those emergency items into your car. Stay glued to reliable information sources, NOAA weather radio, your local NWS office website or social media, your local emergency management agency.
Stay informed.
Critically. If you haven't been ordered to evacuate yet, take some last-minute precautions, avoid any open flames outdoors, extinguish cigarettes completely, maybe bring in flammable items from your yard like cushions or doormats, and make sure your car's gas tank is full.
Good tips. And finally.
Finally, go act early if evacuation orders are issued for your area. Don't wait. Follow your personal wildfire action plan. Leaving early not only keeps you safe, but it also keeps roads clear for emergency vehicles and helps firefighters focus on fighting the fire, not rescuing people.
Don't wait to be told twice.
Definitely not. And only return home when officials explicitly say it's safe. Post-fire hazards are real unstable trees, snags, down power lines, hidden hot spots or ash pits, potential gas leaks. Limit your exposure to smoke and ash and be careful about food and water safety if the power was out. And maybe register on the American Red Cross Safe and Well website so family and friends know you're okay.
And for that real-time awareness, especially about the weather conditions like red flag warnings, services like iAlert.com can be really useful, right? Sending official government alerts straight to your phone via text or email.
Yes, tools like that can provide crucial, timely information. Fire weather watches, red flag warnings, rangeland fire danger statements, helping you stay one step ahead and make informed decisions quickly.
Well, we've certainly journeyed through the intricate world of wildland fire management today, from the fundamental science of fire itself to this complex, collaborative national strategy aimed at building resilience across our incredibly diverse landscapes.
It's a huge challenge, no doubt about it.
But one, it seems we're actively working to meet, albeit with a long road ahead.
Yeah. And if we connect all this back to the bigger picture, that vision of living with wildland fire isn't just a catchy phrase. It really signifies a shift. It's not solely about fighting fires anymore. It's about this continuous collaborative effort.
Integrating everything we talked about.
Right. Integrating individual responsibility, hardening your home, being prepared with community-level action, strategic land management across vast areas, and importantly, making peace with the fact that fire is an inherent and often ecologically necessary process in many places. It's definitely a long game. It requires patience, persistence, and working together.
So as you, our listener, reflect on this deep dive, maybe consider what's one immediate actionable step you can take today, this week. Something to move yourself, your family, your community just a little bit closer to being fire adapted. Understanding that truly every effort, no matter how small it seems, really does contribute to a safer future for us all.